Rainy Night in Portland. Uit 1977 was dat. Watty Burnett. Die zong het. Opgenomen in de Black Ark Studio. Door Lee Scratch Perry natuurlijk. En drie stukken waren het eigenlijk. Nou ja, de eerste van de drie was de alternate mix. Die ook veel langer was. En wel een half minuut langer, 40 seconden langer. 1977, die ook anders klinkt. Watty Burnett ook weer. Rainy Night in Portland, waar allemaal grote 12 inches. En op 4 minuut 40, dan start hij opnieuw en dan zit er een soort dub. Dat hoor je twee keer, maar daar middenin nog een keer. Alleen die dub dan, maar dan die toch weer anders was. Zoals werd uitgegeven in Megawatt Dub in 1997 nog een keer. Rainy Night Dub heet hij dan, daar in het midden. Dus fijn. En voor die drie stukken reggae Atoms and Stars van Howard Jones, van de verzamelaar Miniatures 2. Uit het jaar 2000. Dan gaan we nu naar een stukje punkmuziek. En je luistert naar Patapoe Action. A-N-A-L, Anaal, uit Duitsland. Ich häng mich auf was altijd de hit al vroeger, heel vroeger bij Radio Dood al. En,
ik hang me op.
Ik hang mij op. En een soort crossover funk hardcore muziek. Altijd, het zijn diverse lieden hebben een soort funk intro. En gaan dan toch hele snelle muziek maken, gelukkig. Land der Lüge. Ik weet niet waar het over gaat. Waarschijnlijk over Duitsland en over het verleden of zo. Over hoe het heden juist dat wordt gelogen. A-N-A-L, A-N-A-L, Anaal, Land der Lüge, 1986, Patapoe Action.
The stream of refugees fleeing from Red Tyranny swells into a veritable spring flood. As many as 1,000 a day have reached the temporary haven of West Berlin, here to pause on their way to the freedom that is Western Germany. With U.S. aid, a new refugee registration center has been opened in the American sector. Here the escapees are screened, housed, and fed. And here they await air transport to the West and a chance to live again.
We'll be right back.
Ja, dat was een tune, main theme van een film uit 1966, Spy Against the World. Claudius Alsner is daar verantwoordelijk voor. Op de een of andere manier. Claudius Alsner, Spy Against the World. Main theme, 1966. En daarvoor, Refugees Flee to West Germany from East Germany. 1954 van Universal International Newsreel. Vluchtelingen die warm worden opgevangen in het vrijheid. En dat is 1954. En daarvoor ANA, Land der Lügen, 1986. Je bent mooi en intelligent en je luistert naar Patapoe Action. We gaan luisteren naar muziek uit Zuid-Afrika, Abafana Basekudeni. En het is een opname uit 1975. Nisa Kutanda, Abafana Basekudeni uit Zuid-Afrika, Patapoe Action.
We are the papa.
Airing on Asheville FM 103.3 LPFM in Asheville, this is The Final Straw Radio, a weekly anarchist and anti-authoritarian broadcast and podcast emanating out of occupied Chalagi land in southern Appalachia. We bring you voices and perspectives from projects and struggles all around the world, and you can find our archives, transcripts, ways to follow us and support us at thefinalstrawradio.noblogs.org. This week we're sharing an interview with Tom Huyens, professor of history at Salisbury University and author of Johann Most, Life of a Radical, out last year from University of Illinois Press, speaking about the life and times of the atheist and propagandist and his development from social democrat, parliamentarian, to social revolutionary, to anarchist. For this chat, we talk about Most's life, development, and legacy from the mid-1800s in Bavaria up to his death in 1906 in the U.S. We hope you enjoy the chat. If you're listening to the radio edition, please consider visiting our website for an additional 20 minutes of interview or finding it on one of the many streaming apps that are available at tfsr.media.
My name is Tom Huyens, and I am a history professor at Salisbury University in Salisbury, Maryland. and I teach American history, and my research is the immigrant anarchist movement, transnational. That's sort of where I teach and where I work right now.
Thanks a lot for being here. I really appreciate it.
Mm-hmm. Thanks for having me.
Mm-hmm. My pleasure. So we're here to speak about your recently published book, Johann Most, Life of a Radical, from University of Illinois Press. But looking through your past books, I'm seeing more of what you're talking about with like transnational and immigrant anarchist communities, having written before about German and Yiddish-speaking anarchist immigrants from Central Europe who made their way to organizing in New York in the latter part of the 19th and 20th centuries. That's like a theme in some of your other books. I wonder if you could talk a bit more about this focus, what brought you to it, and some of the larger patterns that you see of who these communities were and what brought them to the U.S.?
Yeah, so I guess I've always been interested in radical immigrants since undergrad, which I did in Belgium. I'm from Belgium originally. I worked on Belgian immigrants in undergrad, and I could also read German and French. I cannot read Yiddish, but Yiddish is often quite close to German. So I had that interest already. And then later on, I kind of discovered some books by historians like Paul Average, Bruce Nelson, Ronald Cree, who sort of wrote on American anarchism specifically. And I sort of was hooked on that. And then I discovered sort of a gap in our knowledge, you could say, especially on German anarchists in urban America, let's say, and this is sort of the 1870s to 1910 or so, specifically in New York. So I kind of wanted to do something there. I wasn't sure at the time. I met Paul Average briefly, and he strongly encouraged I should do this. And so that was all it took. So I knew there was a long history of migration of German radicals to United States since 1848, and maybe even earlier. And this was not a large migration, but they were people very much infused with republicanism with a small r and free thought. And that really was attractive to me. And I would say the German socialists and anarchists who came a bit later are part of that sort of history of German radicals who at first looked up to the American Republic and then became very critical of it. So there was, of course, literature on German socialists, but very little on German anarchists. And then, of course, I discovered the role of Freiheit, which is this one of the longest lasting anarchist publications, which was not only printed in German, but also had the kind of Gothic letters. And sometimes I wonder if that's sort of impeded people from really looking into it. And so that's how I basically got started. This is where I discovered Johann Most, who was a central figure there. I published this in the book Beer and Revolution is a whole sort of social history of this movement in New York, especially. The communities were quite insular, but in some ways very internationalist at the same time. The Yiddish-speaking movement, like I said, I cannot read Yiddish, but they are an adjacent community or a movement. They may have perhaps a little different history. They certainly are alternative communities once they arrive in the U.S. So the Yiddish and German live very close together geographically, especially in New York and Philadelphia, and sort of build this kind of a community of its own language, literature, proletarian culture, you could say. And there's a lot of affinity, I think is a good word to use, between these movements once they are sort of a self-proclaimed anarchist community. Many Yiddish Jewish anarchists could understand German. And I think you could, to bring it back to Johann Most, he really influenced the Yiddish Jewish community in a major way. And perhaps even sort of helped inspire Jewish anarchism, Jewish radicalism, which, of course, outlasted the German community. Maybe one difference is the German anarchists tended to come from sort of an artisan professions, skilled workers, and the Yiddish radicals tended to be more as they came in larger numbers to the United States, they were more sort of industrial workers, usually in the garment industry. So that's sort of, you know, when I did work on German anarchists in America, it's inevitable that the Jewish movement sort of enters into it.
So for folks who do know the name Johann Most, what images are likely to come to mind? And how did this image come about? What is your book looking to shift in this?
Yeah, this was a major aspect for me about Johann Most's legacy, you could say. A major reason, perhaps, to write a scholarly biography. Most people will be able to sort of conjure up a cartoon caricature of an anarchist, a usually disheveled, mad bomb thrower, you know, depicted in cartoon form in the American press, with, you know, wild-eyed, or, you know, holding a bomb or having a knife between the teeth and things like that. So this became a kind of a trope well into the 20th century. And in some ways, I argue the origin of that figure was actually Johann Most, because, and there's several reasons for it, because Most had physical attributes that you could well imagine some cartoonist sort of exploiting. He was kind of slight stature, had disheveled hair, and his face was deformed, which is an aspect of his childhood. We can go into that perhaps a bit later, but obviously to no fault of his own. And the other reason is the moment he arrives in the United States in 1882, and for a few years to come, his public speaking, his activism, was really focused on a type of propaganda by the deed. He did talk about dynamite and even revolutionary terrorism. And I think to many Americans or the reading public, this kind of congealed into this stereotype. It's not an unusual feature. This happened to a lot of people, most infamously for African Americans or Irish immigrants, were often sort of, you know, summed up in the press as this very unflattering cartoon image. So the same was true for anarchists. In a way, you could say that Most perhaps was partly to blame for the sort of genesis of this cartoon. You could add to this, you know, his speaking style. He had sort of a high-pitched voice. He was a fabulous orator, but he had a gesticulating style. And so this probably was inspiration enough for the media, which was then very much newspapers, for this cartoon to kind of stick. So the book, in one way, is an attempt to uncover who the real Most is behind this facade, behind this cartoon. And it's a cartoon he himself sort of helped create in some ways. He almost always spoke in German and very rarely sort of, as we today would call it, like pushed back to sort of a media distortions. And so this image basically stuck. I start the book that way. The very first sort of anecdote is that sort of genesis of this cartoon image. And the role of especially the daily newspapers who seem to be kind of in the business of distorting all kinds of things.
Yeah, I guess on that point, like, I hadn't really thought about the, like, lack of pushback. There are examples in the book where absolutely there are fictions published about the circumstances under which he was arrested, for instance, that were just replicated and amplified in various daily newspapers. I guess he could have written a letter to them and said that's actually not true. You express that the papers sometimes, when allowed to actually talk to Most or to be present for some of his court hearings where he defended himself, even some of the more reactionary bourgeois papers, very pro-business papers, nativist papers to some degree, had to kind of give it to him and say, oh, well, that's a reasonable point that like doesn't really reflect what the court is trying to do here in these circumstances.
Yes, I think an important event is, of course, which I'm sure we'll get into, is Haymarket, which really changed so much in terms of the perception, and understandably so. But so, for example, when Most was living in London, just before he arrived in the United States, he was also involved in a well-publicized court case about publishing an op-ed, essentially. And many papers in the United States covered this with sort of a slight almost defense of not Most's ideas, but his right to express them. And so he does come to the U.S. as perhaps an eccentric person, or he's seen as an eccentric person, definitely a curiosity. He goes on a lecture tour, on two lecture tours, and this is really where he sort of lets loose his kind of theories of revolutionary warfare, even. He starts to mention some sort of American figures, not royalty, of course, but, you know, sort of robber barons. And the press becomes perhaps a little more concerned. Sort of the tone becomes from slight interest or mocking to, well, this guy is crazy and could potentially be a threat. So, yes. So, and again, it's true. Most could have really perhaps defended himself, certainly better. It's one of those aspects of his life. He could speak in English, but not very well. And his style of speaking involved a lot of puns and new words that he invented that were very funny, but only to Germans. Mm-hmm. So he felt very comfortable in his abilities to communicate in German. But that was a disadvantage, I think, once he came to the United States. And I realize that is sort of an interpretation I put on it. But he is constantly writing about the American press as being unscrupulous and worse than European press.
Not to go too far down this, but I guess there's also something to, like, someone who has aspirations towards theater and monologues and public speaking in that way, and also someone who edits newspapers, there's a monologue element to that of, like, oh, if I just make the argument, I guess it's just like it should influence you enough. You're talking back to me. You don't talk back to the actor on the stage. Maybe that's a, I don't know, postmortem interpretation too, but yeah, comfort level.
Yeah. I think there is definitely a theatrical element. Undoubtedly, he makes those links himself. And in fact, as an activist later on in the 1890s, he starts a theater company with overtly political goals in conveying a revolutionary message by other means. It's not so much that Most didn't enjoy polemics or would, I mean, he writes thousands and thousands of op-eds and often repeats some things in other writings. It's just that it doesn't land with the right people, so to speak, when he keeps writing in German. Mm. And especially using some of the rhetorical devices, I guess you could say, that really only work in German. There's people around him who keep telling him, you should have an English version of this. He does here and there speak sometimes in English and contributes to some writing in English, but it's a tiny amount given his entire sort of work.
Well, so yeah, we've given some little snippets, I guess, of like his life, but I wonder if you could kind of...
Je staat onder de douche. Je bent helemaal naakt. En je luistert naar Patapoe Action. Action. Het radioprogramma voor de snop. Action. Het programma voor mensen met belachelijk goede smaak. Action. Voor gekke mensen. Voor leuke mensen. Voor belangrijke mensen. Ja, want Patapoe Action is namelijk echt het radioprogramma voor jou. Met kunst, gezelligheid, feiten, onderzoek, aannames, maar ook intuïtie, gevoel en diepe, diepe gedachten. Maar niet heus hoor, er is natuurlijk alleen muziek. Muziek hier bij Patapoe Action. Brazilië, 1969, Caetano Veloso, Irene.
daqui. Eu não tenho nada. Quero ver Irene rir. Quero ver Irene dar sua risada. Eu quero ir, minha gente. Eu não sou daqui. Eu não tenho nada. Quero ver Irene rir. Quero ver Irene dar sua risada.
Eu vi que você tava com cara de quem não ia cantar, né?
Tava esquecido, rapaz. Quando me lembrei, já foi em cima da hora. Ah, meu Deus! Ah! Um, dois, três.
Eu não sou daqui, eu não tenho nada. Quero ver Irene rir, quero ver Irene dar sua risada. Eu quero ir, minha gente, eu não sou daqui. Eu não tenho nada, quero ver Irene rir. Quero ver Irene dar sua risada. Eu não tenho nada. Quero ver Irene rir. Quero ver Irene dar sua risada. Eu quero ir, minha gente. Eu não sou daqui. Eu não tenho nada, nada. Quero ver Irene rir. Quero ver Irene dar sua risada. Eu não tenho nada. Quero ver Irene rir. Quero ver Irene dar sua risada. Eu quero ir, minha gente. Eu não sou daqui. Eu não tenho nada, nada, nada. Quero ver Irene rir. Quero ver Irene dar sua risada.
Puinhoop, dat was de band Puinhoop. Hebben we wel eens één keer eerder, geloof ik, iets van gedraaid. Puinhoop uit Groningen. 1984 dit. CP heette dat nummer. Of CP1, want er is ook nog een CP2. Onverstaanbaar. Ik kan de tekst niet vinden. Ik denk dat het gaat over de Centrumpartij. Dus een soort fascistische partij die we toen hadden in 1984. En iedereen dacht dat het weer terugging naar Hitler en de jaren 30. Toen al. Hoewel toen ook wel echt militante, agressieve fascisten rondliepen op straat, hoor. Daar niet van. Dat was ook wel aan de hand. Maar het leefde zeker niet in de bevolking. Alleen in de punk-subcultuur die werd bestreden. Het zult laat natuurlijk blijken met geld ook van de CIA. Want het is, ja. Hoe dan ook. Maar dat was jaren 80, die kut jaren 80. 1984 in Groningen. Puinhoop, CP1. Daarvoor Irene. Van de 1969 LP van Caetano Veloso. Dit van een hele mooie vinyl opname filmpje wat ik zag. Dus het knettert wel een klein beetje. Maar in glorieuze mono. En wat moet ik er verder over zeggen? Niks. Ja, dat ik hem al eens eerder heb gedraaid in 2009. zag ik in mijn administratie. Nee, een fan belde op. Net, ik was net op Twitter. Twitter ontplofte. Die heeft hij al eens gehad. Ja, sorry. Dat is waar. Maar essentiële muziek. Caetano Veloso, Irene van hun, zijn 1969 plaat. Nu dan gaan we naar de geschiedenis van de radiopiraterij. Dat is altijd piraterij geweest. En bestreden. En er zat ook soms een politiek element aan. En weet ik veel wat. Nou, op een gegeven moment zaten we met Radio Veronica. Die vanaf een schip voor de kust net buiten een van de zones, waardoor het dan niet meer illegaal was. Dus Nederland bestraalde met de middengolf muziek op de 192. De 129, 192 meter band, weet ik wat. Twee mensen daar was. De een was Joost en de ander was Tieneke. Joost de Draaier, Willem van Kooten, grote muziekproducer geworden. En was dus DJ. En Tieneke de Nooi. Ja, goed. Die hebben dus samen een plaatje gemaakt in 1963, waarin steeds moest worden gesuggereerd dat zij als piraten op een schip daar de radio aan het doen waren. Dat het helemaal niet waar was, want ze hadden gewoon een kantoorgebouw in Hilversum met studio's. Daar werden al die programma's gemaakt en die werden dan naar dat schip gebracht. En daar werden de banden afgedraaid. Dus alleen voor de publiciteit kwamen ze ooit wel eens op het schip. Maar goed, hier wordt gesuggereerd alles voor het schip. Het schip, het schip. En Tieneke heeft een hele bijzondere zangstem die ik je ook niet wil onthouden. Dus dat krijgen we nu. Hey Joost, hey Tieneke uit 1963. Ja, dat dus. Behalve dat ik zie dat CP1, 1984 van Puinhoop, duurde maar 15 seconden. Dus daarom komt hij nu nog een keer. Patapoe Action.
Hey, hey, Tieneke, ik mag je reuze graag. Hey, hey, Tieneke, dat is voor jou toch heus geen vraag. Maar je weet hoe dat gaat, als een echte piraat hoort heel mijn hart aan ons schip. Oh, ons schip. Oh, ons schip.
Hey, hey, Joost. Ja, ook ik zit in het schip. Hey, 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 Joost. Doe alsjeblieft, kijk niet zo sip. Ook jou mag ik graag. Dat is toch geen vraag. Heel mijn hart gaat uit naar het schip.
Schip komt bij ons op de eerste plaats. Hoe kan het anders hier buiten gaat? Wij hopen vurig dat u nog heel lang luistert naar onze muziek van het schip. Oh, ons schip, hey, hey, Tieneke. We zitten samen in de boot.
Hey, hey, Joost. Jawel, desnoods tot onze doos.
Schip komt bij ons op de eerste plaats. Hoe kan het anders hier buiten gaan? Een vuren dat u nog heel lang luistert naar onze muziek van het schip, ons schip.
Save the Hardcore was de naam van, van dat nummer. Save the Hardcore. 1995, Placid K uit Italië, die we laatst ook al hadden gehad. Save the Hardcore. Daarvoor Joost en Tineke. Hey Joost, hey Tineke. 1963 en daarvoor nog weer de herhaling van Puinhoop. CP1, 1984, omdat het zo kort duurde. Nu ga je vlug, want je wil fuzz. En inderdaad, dat nummer met fuzzgitaar. Dat gaan we nu laten horen. Een band uit Kansas City. Een opname waarschijnlijk uit 1967, denk ik. The Dearly Beloved. En het nummer is de totaal afgezaagde. De fuzz klassieker I Can Only Give You Everything. God, hoe heet het? Nou ja, je weet toch. Het staat op de tweede plaat van Dem. En het is 100 miljoen keer gecoverd. En de bedoeling was dat het de hit werd na Satisfaction. De grote fuzz hit. Wat het dus niet is geworden, maar gelukkig wel tientallen keren gecoverd. Maar deze kennen we nog niet. I Can Only Give You Everything van The Dearly Beloved uit Kansas City, Amerika. Patapoe Action.
Make the light. Ida wande sukubroko eh. Ida mrincha mai ne kisimi. Ida wande sukusaka eh. Chora Mario ni mufar Uncle F Dracula bro.
Ua mai didi mbeki.
Even anders was het weer eens met Danino op voorzang. Noti mi no do ding. 2026. Noti mi no do ding. Even anders. 2026. Uit Suriname. En daarvoor uit Amerika. Wat had ik ook gezegd? Kansas City. The Dearly Beloved, I Can Only Give You Everything. Waarschijnlijk opgenomen in 1967. Je hebt een windje gelaten en je luistert naar Patapoe Action. We gaan vlug nu naar wat experimentele muziek van rond het jaar 2000. Nou ja, van die compilatie Free Speech for Sale, waar ik zo vaak al dingen van heb gedraaid, maar deze nog niet. Richard Holland heet deze. Het zou een Engelsman zijn, die doet de toetsen en weet ik veel wat. Maar monteert ook leuke grappige reclames in elkaar. Om daar hier de verbinding tussen vrijheid van meningsuiting en commercie aan de kaak te stellen, zoals al die andere tracks ook deden. Bij Free Speech for Sale 2002, je weet toch. Dit is Toenail Fungus, Richard Holland. Toenail Fungus, Patapoe Action.
You worked too hard, you ate too much, the shit made you greedy. But you're in it, and some appear this messy trouble speedy.
I'm gonna swear. I want relax. Down here in Babylon. The living is rough, the going is tough. Down here in Babylon, they hide the truth away from the youth. Down here in Babylon, brothers killing brothers just for fun. People working hard in the burning sun. I still feel the chains around my feet and the cry of poverty from people that we meet. Tribal war won't solve the problem. Let your hands and hearts be pure and clean.